Welcome to The American Ingredient, a podcast that examines race in American society from an academic perspective. Focusing on the work from social scientists and legal scholars, The American Ingredient demonstrates that race is not the only ingredient in making America, but in order to make America, you need two heaping spoonfuls. Numerous scholars have highlighted that the way we frame problems shapes how we attempt to solve them. This is crucial understanding why the government chooses one solution over another. Regarding the problem of black male achievement, one particular frame that has been consistent is the belief that the black family is dysfunctional and that black men have failed in their role as leaders of their households. In his 2017 bid for the Alabama Senate seat, Roy Moore insinuated that black families were a wreck and were better under slavery. Others such as Michelle Bachmann, Rick Santorum, and President Donald Trump have also made similar assertions that black families are poorly structured and are failing black children. However, they are not alone. Democrats have also made similar statements. On two occasions, President Obama has chastised black men for contributing to the dysfunction of black families. More recently, the organization Color of Change and Family Story released a report finding that media portrayals of black families encourage myths of black family dysfunction and show white families as being the ideal type. These portrayals by politicians and the media provide a frame for the problem of black male achievement that leads to specific policy solutions that may actually be detrimental for black male achievement. In today's podcast, I interview Anthony Brown, a professor in the Department of Curriculum and Instruction in the College of Education at the University of Texas at Austin. Professor Brown's work examines how this interpretation of the black family came about, persisted, and influenced policymaking. We begin the interview with Professor Brown detailing the purpose of his latest project.
Well, one of the things that I try and do is locate like contemporary issues related to African-American males within historical spaces. It's fascinating even to just ask a layperson, what do you see as the most pressing issues related to African-American males? They think about it for a moment. I mean, talking to a person has no interest in this area. They're not studying it. They're not in the social sciences. And they think for about 2 minutes and they say, well, I think there might be some issues with fathers. Mm-hmm. They don't have fathers. They don't have families. So the next question I ask is, where did you learn that? And they can't think of where they learned that. They can't say, well, I read it in Time magazine, or I remember reading a report or a course I took at University of Texas. It's just the way they think about it. And say, well, what do you think, secondly, are the policy recommendations attached to that particular issue? They think for a moment, they ponder, and then they say, I think they need more mentors and role models. And then I follow with the question. I say, well, where did you learn that? And I say, well, it just seems like it's just out there. I just kind of know. Mm-hmm. And I say, well, why do they need more role models and mentors? And it's like, well, because they don't have fathers in their lives. So they have this very linear argument that's already anchored. So if I ask a layperson, a principal, other parents, we had that particular narrative. And that narrative frames the creation of schools, the necessity to hire more black male teachers. But what it does is it delimit any other kind of question that we can ask. We're talking about a complex problem. Mm-hmm. I'll turn to people in different professions, like in the medical field, and say, well, when you're making a decision, when someone comes in with a heart problem, they say, I'm having some issues that, see, symptoms, well, what do you think of? Well, they'll think of multitude of things. They list out all these variables. Say, well, what if you only had one or two things? So we'd have high likelihood of death. I mean, you just cannot approach a medical condition with that. And I said, well, one of the things I say is that we cannot think of educational problems as complex and massive and historically entrenched and reduce it to this particular sociological narrative. And it was amazing to me, the durability in the 60s, 70s, 80s, it changes, mm-hmm. but it always comes back to that. Because in some cases, it's already in the lexicon. It's already a way that we think about problems. And it probably provides some capital. I mean, you start saying that black boys need particular things and you want people to pay attention, the problems have to be framed in the ways that we already know them. And that's the kind of crux of my work. And as it pertains to the social sciences, there was some things I was noticing over the years is that the way we talk about educational discourse, like the ways in which we reason about the experiences related to African-American males in particular, mm-hmm. and African-American families was directly related to these kind of like old ways that we've been thinking about sociology. I mean, you could take ideas from something E. Franklin Frazier wrote in the 1930s and literally cut and paste them.
There are several scholars that Professor Brown will mention, and I want to give a little bit of background about them. The first is E. Franklin Frazier, and he was a Black sociologist whose studies on Black life in the mid-20th century heavily influenced the field of sociology, and his book related to the family, The Free Negro Family, A Study of Family Origins Before the Civil War, has been viewed by many as being pivotal in the study of Black family dynamics. And it's important to note that he was extremely influential, actually becoming the first African-American to serve as the president of the American Sociological Association. In addition to E. Franklin Frazier, you also have St. Clair Drake, another sociologist and anthropologist who is famous for his studies of Black life in the Deep South as well as the urban North. His book, Black Metropolis, which was co-authored with Horace R. Caton Jr., chronicled the lives of Blacks in Brownsville neighborhood on Chicago's South Side. Along with his several other works, he is viewed as being really one of the key figures in understanding urban sociology and how urban settings influence social interactions with individuals. And finally, Charles Johnson, another Black sociologist who worked in the early part of the 20th century, chronicled the lives of Blacks in the urban North and Deep South. He would become the first Black president of Fisk University, a historically Black college in Nashville, Tennessee. But he would also serve on federal commissions and White House advisory boards. All three of these men received their PhDs from the University of Chicago in sociology. And in many ways, the approaches from the Chicago School heavily influenced how we understood the Black family, with these three individuals being key figures in accomplishing that.
You could take ideas from something E. Franklin Frazier wrote in the 1930s and literally cut and paste them within a policy report in the present, and they'd be, you know, it would fit the exact timing. So there was almost a durability of ideas and that we hadn't moved away from. So my first exploration in this was just to really ask the question, well, how have people researched African-American boys and African-American males over time? You know, when you look across multiple disciplines, when the question pertaining to the experiences of African-Americans, what topics come up most and what have been the implications of that? And so for me, it's trying to understand how those ideas and how that narrative arc becomes almost implicitly visible in policy discourse. No one's citing E. Franklin Frazier. No one is citing any of the scholars from the old sociological discourse from the Chicago School of the 30s and 40s. They're not referencing it. It becomes a meta-narrative.
So, Professor Brown, how did the scholars of the 1930s reframe the discussion of the Black family? And how did their work contribute to our current understanding of the Black family?
This was interesting. It was a conceptual shift because up to that point, social sciences perceived African Americans as like biologically deficit. Mm-hmm. So there was something wrong with our blood and our bones and our minds. So this was a huge shift to say that African Americans' problems are ecological, not biological. So this ecological shift, of course, led scholars to look and probe into the experiences of African Americans. And at the time, with race riots all throughout the Northeast and in urban centers, with African Americans migrating there, they wanted to find ways to address this kind of racial problem. So the impetus was centered on issues happening in St. Louis and Chicago. And one of the things they found is that they started studying the family. I mean, if it's ecological, it occurs within the ecology of the family. And that became the most prominent discourse of its time. So I'd say by the 30s and 40s, a bulk of our discussion was related directly to the family itself. Shifts a little bit by the 50s and 60s with our attention, almost to the sense that what happens to African Americans when they move within a different milieu, when they're now in an urban context as opposed to a rural context, what happens to the father? Where is he located? And in many cases, he was perceived as absent, absent in at least one or two ways, absent from the micro context of the Black family, but absent from social science research. Like, we can't find him. I mean, you could see on in the book in the 1960s, Tally's Corner, this idea that African Americans are not even there's no empirical longitudinal analysis of Black men. So they're seen as not only absent from the home, but absent from research. But they kind of go twofold. Because we don't have access to them in their families. And even when they have access to them, scholars would perceive them, as they call them, peripheral dads, that they're on the margins. They're kind of not around. So this idea from the rural South to urban centers, Black men kind of lost their sense of self, no longer connected to communities and became wandering, absent and wandering. That was kind of the analogy attached to them. It continued through the 60s, but less attention given to their inability, but more that they've been in this situation for so long, they can't imagine a reality other than this. Mm-hmm. So they can't imagine being fathers and being stable, and mothers can't perceive in this way as well. Fascinating thing, 1965, with the publication of Negro Family, Moynihan makes the policy recommendation that says, well, we can't get these black women husbands. We can't do that.
Moynihan, that Professor Brown's referring to, is Daniel Patrick Moynihan. He is famous for the Moynihan Report, or more formally known as the Negro Family, the Case for National Action. Dr. Moynihan, a sociologist who would serve for President Johnson as the Undersecretary of Labor when he wrote this, would also serve and work with President Nixon and serve in the Senate for several terms, wrote this report, and the purpose of the report was to help increase programs to address the deep roots of black poverty. In this report, he concluded that the dysfunction of the black family, specifically the high rate of female-led families, greatly hindered black economic and political progress. And this report is used classically as a way to talk about how the dysfunction of the black family is the root cause of the failure for blacks to advance politically and economically.
But we have this masculine gap or manhood gap. And the manhood gap in the 60s, like one way to compensate for this gap was to put them in the front lines, put them in the military, a place where they could get real manhood, which is, I thought it's just, I had to read that a few times to say that the policy implication was, again, back to absent fatherhood. So they're tangled in a pathology, yet you put them at the front lines. So policy recommendations have always been, they always come back to that. Mm-hmm. All roads lead back to the sociology of the black family. We're talking about recruiting of black fathers, mm-hmm. getting more black fathers involved in schools. It's predicated on these deficits related to black families, bringing more mentors if it's from fraternities, or bring them in after-school programs. Now, one of the things that I have to emphasize, and I hope this is stated here, in no way am I discouraging the implementation of role models or having fraternities involved in schools. But what ends up happening is you take a complex problem and it's reduced just to that. Mm-hmm. So the problems related in schools aren't related to structural issues around housing and taxing that create schools. You know, there's a deficit in what the schools are able to offer them in terms of resources, high attrition rates. All the things that make a school not function structurally are reduced to a micro. The macro is never related in schools. It is purely the micro. And who can better fix the micro is another individual. So all educational discourse, in some cases, becomes a psychological issue and not a sociological issue, or a structural issue, a institutional issue.
One of the first things that stood out to me is that many of these arguments came from black scholars. Think of E. Franklin Frazier. And so there's been this contention between how white social scientists have approached the study of African Americans as opposed to blacks, but we're seeing that this narrative actually started with black social scientists.
Oh, yeah, that's fascinating. I mean, much of the work that was cited by Moynihan was from Kenneth Clark, even some of the work by Sinclair Drake.
The Clark that Professor Brown is referring to is Kenneth Clark, who, along with his wife, Mamie Phipps Clark, were black psychologists whose research focused on young children. They are particularly famous for how their work on the damaging effects of racial segregation on the psyche of black children helped the NAACP secure the victory in the Brown v. Board case. Kenneth and Mamie were the first two blacks to earn a PhD in psychology from Columbia University. And further, Kenneth Clark was the first black president of the American Psychological Association.
I think that's a fascinating thing, and I think there's been some work where E. Franklin Frazier had to kind of backtrack on some of the things that he stated. I have a theory, and I don't know if this is purely anecdotal. I mean, I think African-American men at the time, we know we were increasing numbers going into higher education, increased numbers into certain fields. I would imagine for people like Charles Johnson and E. Franklin Frazier, this was a significant opportunity to be able to get a PhD and do this kind of research. But what ends up happening is, you know, in our field, the question of the day, you're going to gain spoils, you're going to gain capital by the kinds of questions you ask. So the Negro problem was already a problem that was framed in the early 1900s, and sociologists entered into an already existing discourse. Mm-hmm. You begin to question, like, the motives and intentions of researchers. I don't think you stand a chance. I mean, when you even look at their publication record, most of them are in Journal of Negro Education, Journal of Negro History. There's a very small pool of journal spaces that their ideas could reside in, and even where they ended up becoming academics. They were able to go to the University of Chicago and go to Harvard. They mostly ended up at Howard and Tuskegee and many HBCUs. So I think there probably was a tendency to express a discourse that was already there, and there was certainly capital tied to that. And I think there was some dissent when it came to those ideas, but there was no other way in which to imagine the world. I think the world was already organized around that way of that kind of system of reasoning that reduced it to the Black family. Who was going to provide the most precise analysis related to it?
Another thing that you pointed out was this argument that moving from the rural South to the urban North led to this breakdown in, I guess, how Black men related to their families. And this has kind of been a classic trope, even going back to slavery, where the idea is that as Blacks moved out of these rural Southern areas and into the North, that this is when problems occurred.
Yeah.
So how does this regional argument kind of harken back to the days of slavery, or is it like, what exactly is the root of this idea of moving out of the South, moving to the North leads to dysfunction?
Yeah, I've been reading recently. I've gone back to about the 15th century and even some stuff that Winthrop Jordan wrote in the 60s about kind of early Enlightenment ideas around Black men or males of African descent. And one of the things that you see pervasive over time is this idea that Black men can't function in places that have too much stimulation. Like this idea that Black men are naturally libidinous. So I think some of these ideas are packaged within different theories within the social sciences, but the durability of them have a much longer duration that can be traced back to the very beginnings of modernity. So when you're beginning to conceptualize a citizen, the anti-citizen or the non-citizen is the Negro male. In a gender context, it's the female. Black female is almost like written out of it. But the kind of prototypical, the other, the proverbial other becomes Black male. And it's always rooted in his inability to have impulse control. Rural is a simple system, simple social system. The relationships are patriarchal. They're defined in a market economy in the North, in Chicago. Life is far more complex. And they, in many cases, lose their minds. And I can quote things that were offered by even Frazier, where they say they end up in this space, in this particular milieu, and they begin to engage in kind of serial relationships. They no longer remain attached. That's why the idea of wandering becomes pervasive during that time. But I would argue that those ideas were already anchored by kind of modernist philosophical thinkers of the time that just played out in different ways. They played out in the context of slavery through Black men being almost viewed as acquiescing simpletons. They're attached to this simple economy. They need discipline in order to function in it. But they were also implicit in that they were the brute. But they didn't explicitly become analogous to the brute until after emancipation, when the idea is that we can't control them. So these ideas of control and space, I think, we could trace them to the 8th and 9th century. It just happened to play out in different ways in the context of theological discourse and scientific discourses in during the period to justify enslavement. And then in the context of the Negro problem of the 20th century, it plays out in different ways. But it's all the foundation of it is the idea that Negro men have a kind of peculiar carnality. You see it theologians talked about it in the 1900s. Of course, scientists, that's the premise of the idea that something is peculiar about our bodies. You even see this play out in a recent documentary I saw where Daryl Gates is justifying why at the time, you might correct me on this, it might have been between 9 to 12 men had died of chokeholds within a year through the LAPD. And his justification was that Black men have a kind of, their bodies don't operate normally to the chokehold. And that's why they're dying. So again, these kind of scientific arguments. This is the chief of police giving a press conference and arguing that there is something about the biological composition of the Black male that makes them die, that other people, if I chokehold them, they would not die. So I think it's reduced to the body. It's also reduced to the soul in some sense. And I don't mean just the soul, like the actual the makeup of Black men, the essence of them, that makes them not able to function in a complex setting. And we see those discourses in schools. In one context, white males in private schools, they're sitting on couches reading books. But when you look at a school based on a particular reform for Black males in Chicago, they need blue blazers, they need the white shirt and the tie, and the body needs to be erect. There has to be a certain disciplining, and that disciplining is going to come largely from Black men of size, of stature. So there's a governing that is attached to Black males. And this is controversial stuff because I have to almost qualify. Yes, we need more Black male teachers. They make up less than 1% of the population. Mm-hmm. But I think what we have to trouble, when it gets privileged in this particular way, what undergirds the arguments for needing a particular kind of Black man in schools? Mm-hmm. And even at the study I did, a ethnography on 10 Black male teachers that work with Black male students. And what happened is that these Black male teachers didn't even realize that they were enveloped within this discourse. Mm-hmm. They didn't even realize. In fact, it almost through the study came to the realization is that all I am? I'm a disciplinarian? Mm-hmm. I'm not a thinker, a scientist, a mathematician, a history teacher. The utility of me as a teacher is only to function to govern Black boys. Mm-hmm. That was troubling to many of them because they spent many years learning about reading and literacy and how to teach and pedagogy. Mm-hmm. All those things were kind of their pride of their work, but they realized that most of the world around them, even promotion, how do you get out of the classroom, become a principal, your ability to manage other Black boys. You do that well, you get a raise.
In many ways, Black men have been championed for this. So if you think of the movie Lean on Me, I think there were, I guess, Black educators almost come off as drill sergeants, and they're seen as the heroes.
Yes.
So you have the strong Black male comes in and kind of gets, and all of a sudden everybody magically learns.
Yeah. I mean, that one of the things that gets missing from that, again, going back to the men in this study, is there may be a certain sternness, but when you study the men, there's a whole bunch of thought that goes into it. Mm. And what's fascinating, too, is that the different ideological stances that the men, I mean, some are very strong nationalists. Mm-hmm. Some of them are cultural nationalists. Some of them believe in assimilation. But they all kind of adhere tacitly to the belief that Black men have to be physically present when interacting with Black boys in urban settings, mm-hmm. particularly the place where I did my study. But I think one of the things that the pervasive of this is that, again, the whole world reduces all problems to Black boys, to their inability to control their bodies. So what better body to control another body is one that looks like it. So it kind of has this role model thesis, you know, the idea that I'm going to be informed by certain behaviors and dispositions. I'll see those behaviors and dispositions, and I want to mimic those behaviors and dispositions, and I can achieve at the same level. And there's certain some truth to that. But if we see that in a linear sense, you reduce all of the pedagogical processing that these men put into the work that they do. They're not just in any moment rolling up on a Black boy in a hallway. Mm-hmm. They know what he can take. They know when to do it. When you begin to lay out the nuances pedagogically what they do, it's quite amazing. But yeah, there's certainly a discourse that says manhood and masculinity are attached to the Black nation. Mm-hmm. The Black nation cannot heal. It plays out in micro context. So the kind of political discourse of the Million Man March and other institutional things are like, if the health of the community can only function, the Black body politic, if mm-hmm. we think of this in an analogous sense, can only function if the Black male body is healthy and strong and standing out in front of the issues related to it. And it was, you know, feminists have had major issues over the time, but it is certainly a prominent discourse, and many of us hear to it. And in many cases, when they hear me talk to them, they go, I never thought about it that way. They never really think that there are other ways to imagine it. Maybe it's because there's a skepticism that no one will address our problems. Mm-hmm. I recall sitting in a panel session here in the city around what to do for African-American males. And a professor and I were sitting in the audience, and then we noticed that only the questions they were asking were about ties and how Black boys pull their pants up, all these things related to it. And we said, well, there's some major structural issues like how schools are represented, where they can go to school, decisions families can make. We need to ask those questions as well. Quickly responded, we know that structural and institutional issues exist, but we can't control that readily. but we can control what a black boy brings into schools. And it's just the way we think about it. That's why I call it a master narrative. There's no theory attached to it. It just becomes the reason why we approach the work we do. And there's probably some capital that comes from it. Funding of a school, more resources come in. So if you present the problem in the typical sociological way, again, it's going to give you a promotion. It's going to give you a grant. It's going to give you opportunities. Mm-hmm. If you begin to question in a way, I think it creates a little bit of dissonance where, well, let's go study high-achieving African-American males in middle-class settings or private elite schools. Maybe not. If I could frame it within a trope of getting out of the hood and then study it that way, I think it would have appeal. But just to study it for its own purposes, I think people would be less... there wouldn't be less of an impetus to study that particular work. I recall years ago giving a presentation in a district to 300 teachers. And I said, imagine for a moment if Banana Republic, the Fisher Foundation, who does Banana Republic, Old Navy, and Gap, they give money. They're major philanthropists for education. And I said, what if they said they were going to hire 10, 15 tailors, and they're going to give all of your boys... three or four press, the tailors are going to come out, they're going to fit the boys' pants, they're going to give them a belt, four different colors pants. And people started kind of clapping, like, that would be fantastic. And I said, if you were able to pull that off, do you believe you'd be able to change the achievement gap in this particular district? Dead silence in the room. Mm-hmm. You know why? Because they know it's not possible. They know that fitted pants won't give you an achievement gap. But why do we pay attention to it? Because we believe that telling a black boy to pull up his pants can fix the problem.
We have this idea of the deterioration of black men and the black family. But what exactly are the facts? I mean, I think one of the things you pointed out is that the way we think about black families is factually incorrect.
Yeah.
So what exactly are the facts?
Well, the CDC came out with a study. And they actually argue, it's the argument that most people will throw out. They'll throw out 90%, 80%. Again, there's an appealing discourse that says, so if you want to appeal to the needs of black males, you have to present their problems attached to the father. Mm-hmm. And the most common one is that 80% of all black boys live without a father. Mm-hmm. Now, what they're looking at is the data that actually says that black females are not married. Mm-hmm. So when you look at black boys, it's something like 1.3 million fathers are involved in their father's lives. So for example, if I was not married to my wife, as much time as I spend with my son and daughter, violin lessons, all the things, Kanan would be living in what was be defined as a fatherless home because he's not married, even though my involvement. So the measurement wasn't that there's a continuum around these, and fathers have different degrees of involvement. And sometimes it has to do with the changing relationship between marriage. People are having children and not getting married at higher rates. In fact, the numbers are changing dramatically. So our reporting of black father involvement is usually attached to that number. But when you look at the number of black males that are involved, they're far greater. In the same study, they studied something like 250 to maybe 300 men, white, Latino, male. And I think they were looking at indicators of like how many males bathe their sons and read to them, involvement. And black men outperformed them. And every single kind of micro measure of what we define as involved with their children and their sons. So some of the things we have to change the way we report the data. Mm-hmm. And that muddies up the water. I mean, how am I now going to say, well, black males are involved? Mm. Where do we go from there? That's because we have a cant. The way we think about it, we already echo certain ideas to get people in public policy to pay attention. This muddies the water up a little bit. And it says, well, where do the problems reside if their fathers are in their lives? Mm-hmm. So when you create a school, I recall this even in my study where black boys the teachers would say something to the boys in the study, and the black boy would turn and say, I have a father. The presumption was I'm here to be a surrogate father. For example, Arne Duncan in 2010-11, his big kind of policy pitch to the world was something called 5 by 2015. He says, by 2015, I want 5% of the teaching population to be black males. And his argument for why, he said, most black boys don't have fathers. So these men could serve as surrogate fathers. No argument about what they can offer pedagogically in the classroom, what they can do in terms of instruction, even relationships and friendships that could occur in the context of schooling, or what they can offer by way of mentorship, but they could serve as surrogate fathers. So even the discourse within wider public policy, and Nike was involved, and Spike Lee was involved, John Legend was involved, it just becomes the way we think about it. It's the default discourse to understand what I see as very complicated issues related to black males.
We know that this is a much more complicated issue, and you mentioned earlier that a lot of discussion is what can we do to change black boys, so whether it be the dressing of the nature, but you actually say it shouldn't be what should we do to change them, it should what we should do to change us to work with them. Yeah. So what are some of the things that you believe schools need to do in order to accommodate the needs of black men?
Teacher training is vital. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think one of the things that teachers aren't giving opportunity is to like really spend some time thinking about this. This one-shot professional development where Anthony Brown comes out and gives you 20 slides about the most pressing issues related to African-American males, and then you go away. There's different degrees of development. So you need spaces where there's large percentages of African-American males, maybe in Detroit, and even certain districts where they represent a small percentage, where there's little interaction with African-Americans. We respond to black boys in a way that requires some unpacking. Mm-hmm. And teachers just, there's a gut response to things that don't require that attention. Remember, we're talking about classrooms. It's in the context, these issues, suspensions, expulsions, we look at the data, mm-hmm. but they happen in the micro context. And it is an individual that is asserting meaning and deploying those meanings. Mm-hmm. And those meanings have huge implications. I'll share a study that recently was done. They gave a picture, they gave 300 early child educators, the guy's name is Gilliam. Mm-hmm. It was a study that was done at Princeton, and they gave them a clicker, and they said, every time you see a challenging behavior in the classroom, so it was an image of a white girl, white male, black girl, black male. So every time you see a challenging behavior in this classroom, we want you to click your clicker every time you see it, and say the black boy is in quadrant A. And it's
mm-hmm. Now, there are no definitive definition of challenging behavior. There are a variety of definitions that exist, but many people point to the definition provided by Powell and colleagues in their 2007 article in the Journal of Early Intervention. They state that a challenging behavior is any repeated pattern of behavior or perception of behavior that interferes with or is at risk of interfering with optimal learning or engagement with pro-social interactions with peers or adults. This concern about challenging behavior is important because the children who repeatedly show challenging behavior are more likely to suffer from learning disabilities as well as face suspensions and expulsions. And so because of this, how we deal with challenging behaviors and who we isolate as having challenging behaviors dictates a great deal of what teachers do day to day, as well as how school districts develop policies to address learning.
So the data was overwhelming. They clicked black boys more than any other group. Here's the irony. There were no challenging behaviors. So they saw challenging behaviors when there were no challenging behaviors, and they saw them more with the group that gets identified in those particular ways. So certainly we have an implicit bias that's happening in schools. And the researchers that have done implicit bias, if it was biased from the beginning, it could be undone. Mm-hmm. And it can only be undone by giving teachers opportunities to really think about the kinds of things that are swimming in their heads about the students they serve, and I think a pervasive one is the sociological stories we tell mm-hmm. about black families. I used to tell my brother-in-law, he would send my mother-in-law and father-in-law to the school, and I'd say, because it's work and mm-hmm. school, he couldn't get there for meetings. I said, you got to get out there because there's being a story is being informed about your daughter that you don't know. And he's kind of frowning and going, well, what do you mean, Anthony? I said, they're thinking that Jalen is being raised by her grandparents. Mm-hmm. So there's no father, there's no mother. I said, you and Cherie, which is his wife, need to go out to that school and shift that. And he never thought about it. You know, just his set of circumstances, and realized that the world will actually frame it in that particular way. So I think we need a lot of time. as much as I critique like our impulses around hiring black men or black teachers with the assumption that this linear relationship, the problem I have with it is that we don't ask any other question. We only see that. And then if you're able to achieve that, the hiring of more black male teachers or get a mentor program involved, and you show black men shaking the black boys' hands and they're giving them high fives and they're working. So you begin to kind of these moments where you capture institutionally what you're doing, but it doesn't anchor or change it because it has no connection to the classroom, curricular practices, pedagogical practices of the classroom. Teachers need a lot of time thinking about what they think when they make decisions in classrooms.
And so what are some of the major challenges you faced in, getting your message out? what kind of pushback are you receiving?
The biggest one early on is people assuming that I'm saying we don't need to hire more black male teachers. That was the number one response. The second response is that my work is too historical and too theoretical, in the sense that schools they want a utility. They want ideas to immediately respond to literacy, immediately respond to math problems. And I said, you ask bigger questions that will allow you to understand why black boys are not getting into the trigonometry, which I just recently saw some data that says in Central Texas, black boys are the lowest, whether in the low SES or in middle class. Every other group outperforms black girls, white males, Asian males, every group. Black males are at the very bottom in terms of getting to at least algebra 2 trig and beyond. So one of the things I want them to understand is like, is that just a math problem? No, that is a bigger socio-historical issue. So my task is to help people understand the trouble the way they think about it. And I just have to sometimes help districts, you know, understand that. And why I do that. So it's like this immediate, you know, I want something where they're going to want to read immediately. And I was like, the problem isn't whether they want to read, it's the fact that you don't even have books that represent them in the classroom, and that is a structural issue because the decision for a teacher today, even if they had the desire to add books, you couldn't go to Barnes & Noble and find those books. You have to be really clever. You have to find bookstores and places. You have to go online. There's this very kind of archaeological thing when you bring knowledge. And whether teachers are willing or capable of doing this is a whole nother issue. But we're not just talking about math. We're talking about problems with knowledge and how do we make that? How do we even make math relevant? Is it just about math or is it something bigger and deeper about the actual like culture of this school is what I try and do. I mean, surprisingly, people have begun to listen to what I have to say related to these issues. But the biggest challenge I've had is that they want solutions immediately.
How are you able to get them to stop looking for this, stop looking for just a very real quick solution and to actually start to look at themselves and how they need to adjust?
Well, one of the things I try and do is I take something that teachers already do. So I'll say something along the lines, how do you teach a child to read? And we'll put on poster paper and teachers will lay out all of these things that they do. And so like if we put a picture of the child in the middle, it's like thousands of arrows going at what they do to scaffold and build a child to eventually become a reader. And the same things I want them to think. I want them to think about multiple things that make possible why black boys are being expelled or suspended at greater rates. What do you think they could be? And once you get to thinking about the things that they're already doing that require complexity and layers of complexity, they realize that they've seen a problem. So I said, imagine if you just had one solution to fix literacy, we'd have a literacy problem because you do so many things to help a child learn how to do literacy. And most teachers will engage those questions. Most police officers will begin. If you begin to think about like, what is it about this particular group? You have already set of ideas and your response is directly tied to those things. First of all, they're black or male, the time of day, the type of car, and there's this reaction to that. Well, the question is why? And I think that's the kinds of questions that we have to ask teachers about. They're already doing complex things. If you ask any math teacher, science teacher, English teacher, there are many different things. When you begin to ask them about like why are black males failing, again, we have this We have a problem with thinking. We're so deeply entrenched in bias. It's very difficult for them to even imagine that there is a space where Black people achieve. I mean, even that in of itself, the idea of showing pictures to my pre-service teachers in the 1800s of African-American men, I show them the picture of Du Bois's Paris, 1900. So I flip through all 350 pictures. And so I don't give them the time frame. I don't give them the context. I just say, I want you to write different things. And they locate it. They don't know where to locate it. They don't know if this is, they know it looks so old that, is it slavery? But it can't be slavery because African-Americans were enslaved. So they're perplexed historically. They don't know even where to locate African-American achievement. And what's ironic is it's all over the place. I had even a student say, I grew up in Maryland, just outside of Washington, D.C., and high-performing African-Americans were all around me. For some reason, I couldn't see it. So even when it's there, it's right there in her presence. She cannot realize. Maybe there could be, you disavow it as an outlier. So there's this particular master narrative of underachievement that's tied to us as a group, African-Americans as a group. And when you see these moments, Black doctor, Black lawyer, president of a university or whatever measurement of achievement we have, you disavow its significance because it's mainly seen as just some type of outlier. It colors even my approach as a parent raising a now 9-year-old African-American male, for example. The other day he left the house it was raining, and he put on a raincoat, and he didn't have an umbrella, and he put the hood on to cover himself. My immediate reaction was to take the hood off.
Yeah.
I get put in this box. If I'm absent, I fit the narrative, but if I'm present, I'm overbearing.
Okay.
So it's very interesting to being a parent in this area. And from the standpoint of a researcher, all I can continue to do is document what I'm seeing. And I don't see these narratives necessarily going away because so many people are invested in them on many different levels, at the level of the researcher, the policymaker, the person who wants to develop a school. If you want to write a book, the narrative itself is appealing. And sometimes that appeal is... I even have to sometimes hear people say, you know, I hear people say, you know, I come from the hood and I have no problem with the hood story. But when you deconstruct it, you realize that particular person, they grew up in Brooklyn, but it was in like a 2-story brownstone. Mm-hmm. And there are tons of African-Americans, including my family, that have 2-story brownstone, 3-story brownstones. But it's in the middle of what we conceptualize. Although I know conceptually Brooklyn has changed.
Yeah,
there's a different imaginary attached to Brooklyn now.
Yeah.
But the 80s and 90s Brooklyn already had a fixed narrative. So to tie your story to that and your journey, it gives you capital.
Yeah.
You could sell that story in a very appealing way. Rather than, no, life has been comfortable my entire life, and here I am today in this particular way. There's you can't write a book. There's no memoir for that. And I think that is the crux of the problem, that the story itself has so many stakeholders invested in it.
Mm-hmm.
It's very hard to get out of this kind of cultural discourse.
Right. Well, Professor Brown, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, this is fun.
It's been a delight to have you here.
Yes, thank you.
As Professor Brown points out, many of these beliefs we have about the Black family and Black men are so deeply entrenched that we cannot break away from them, even though we know how harmful they are. In early April, the Government Accountability Office released a report finding racial bias in school discipline. They found that even in more affluent schools, Black students were punished more often and more severely for similar infractions as their white counterparts. These findings come at a time when President Trump is calling for more punishment of students as a method for improving school safety. As Professor Brown points out, this get tough response does little to actually help student achievement and may even increase the achievement gap between Blacks and their counterparts. We must be aware of the narratives we use to explain a problem, because these narratives can divert our attention from the true causes and may lead to making the problem worse. Thank you for listening to The American Ingredient. I'm Eric McDaniel, a professor in the Department of Government at the University of Texas. I would like to thank Michael Heidenreich and Jacob Weiss for their assistance, along with the Department of Government at the University of Texas and the University of Texas's LEITS Development Studio.
We'll be right back.